The poor duckling, who had crept out of his shell last of all and looked so ugly, was bitten and pushed and made fun of, not only by the ducks, but by all the poultry. "He is too big," they all said, and the turkey cock, who had been born into the world with spurs and fancied himself really an emperor, puffed himself out like a vessel in full sail and flew at the duckling and became quite red in the head with passion, so that the poor little thing did not know where to go and was quite miserable because he was so ugly and laughed at by the whole farmyard. So it went on from day to day till it got worse and worse. The poor duckling was driven about by everyone. Even his brothers and sisters were unkind to him and would say, "Ah, you ugly creature, I wish the cat would get you." And his mother said she wished he had never been born. The ducks pecked him, the chickens beat him, and the girl who fed the poultry kicked him with her feet. So at last he ran away, frightening the little birds in the hedge as he flew over the palings. That's from Hans Christian Andersen's The Ugly Duckling, a story our controversial guest says can be read as a tale of persecution of homosexuals. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The Danish literary canon includes the works of Hans Christian Andersen, Isaac Dennison, and others known for their blend of fairy tale and realism, romance, and social criticism. What happens if you queer the canon or approach it from an alternative perspective? Our guest, Dag Hede, is famous in Denmark as the bad boy of academia who did just that, challenge the accepted way of reading Danish literary giants. Dag Hede, who is a professor of Danish literature at the University of Southern Denmark, joins us during his visit to Madison to explore new approaches to Danish literature.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Now, in literary circles, of course, it seems sometimes that every major figure, a figure such as Andersen or Dennison, has been analyzed in every possible way. And so academically, sometimes it seems as if an approach is just to make elbow room for a new interpretation so you can do something that hasn't been done before. What makes you come to these figures with this particular approach? Were there any particular things in the writings of Andersen, say, that made you think, oh, I don't think this approach has been done?
Well, I think what you're talking about is English literature, where there is a lot more academia, and you have, like, scholars all over the world being familiar with this kind of literature. Now, with Danish literature, it's a very different matter. Denmark is a very small country, and the Danish academia is very small. So there is no talk about different approaches already been exhausted. Actually, we have so much more to do because we are only the ones who can read Danish. So a lot of theoretical approaches have not been tried out on some of this major Danish literary figures from the canon. So it's a very, so it's sort of a virgin field, a virgin country that we have to try out new approaches. And so there's a lot of approaches lacking. For instance, the feminist approach has never been applied in any great measure to the works of Hans Christian Andersen. And I think that is very, very different. I mean, we are not talking about Shakespeare scholarship. We are talking about quite limited scholarship on these giant figures.
So if you look at Hans Christian Andersen, this writer of fairy tales and travelogues and other things, at what point does a flag go up and you say, I think that he is writing from a perspective or somehow writing in a way that will be enlightened if we look at it from a homosexual standpoint?
Well, I want to just be precise. I'm not doing a homosexual reading. I'm doing a queer reading, which is a little bit different.
Why don't you define that? I know within academia, queer theory is something that we're used to hearing, but it's not that broadly understood, and it sounds kind of almost attention-getting. So explain what that is, queer theory.
Oh, it's definitely attention-getting. I mean, we want attention. Every new theoretical movement would like to have attention. And, of course, it's going to be provocative. You take the word queer and you put it together with academia, and people are supposed to, like, be a little surprised. Hey, what is this about? You take a bad word, and how do you read in a queer way? Now, the reason I don't like the word gay studies is, first of all, it's because it's not... that was something we did, or some of us did, in the 70s and in the 80s. And since then, now it's been queer studies. Queer studies, where homosexual, like the gay studies, would try to find the hidden
right.
or secret homosexuals, often in all kinds of ages and cultures.
Sure.
Now, the queer studies know that that would be the wrong question to ask. Now, you can't ask, for instance, if Hans Christian Andersen, who lived between 1805 to 1875, you can't ask whether he was heterosexual or homosexual. It's the wrong kind of question.
Why? Because you think it's unprovable one way or the other?
No. Because the question is anachronistic in itself. There was no homosexual identity or role at the lifetime of Hans Christian Andersen. Asking if Hans Christian Andersen was a homosexual is just like asking if he was a socialist or if he was a cyclist.
But
you get it.
But you could certainly ask if Oscar Wilde was. So
yes.
You're saying it's just
but
that he was too early.
Exactly.
It was too early for Andersen.
So one could hypothesize if Hans Christian Andersen had been born 50 years later, then you could ask that question. But then I would counter that and say then he wouldn't have been Hans Christian Andersen.
Right.
Do you get it?
Yes.
So, well, in queer studies, and this goes back to a French philosopher, Michel Foucault, who wrote The History of Sexuality, one of the founding books of queer theory, he states, and he just puts this date, he says, the homosexual was born in 1869. And by here...
As
by
a
that,
concept...
Yes.
And is there a particular event or?
Yes.
Yes.
That was sort of there. The word was coined in medical literature for the very first time. Now, we shouldn't, of course, fix on that date, but he says it provocatively because these identities, these sexual identities, such as homosexual and heterosexual, are much more new and modern than we might think. Like, it's not like people of same sex have not had relationships and feelings and sexual activity before 1869. That's not the way to think about it. But the identity of the modern homosexual and all the cliches and the imaginations we have about that, something, you know, with a dominant, well, for, if we talk about gay, male homosexual, something with a dominating mother and absent father and all those cliches, they would have been meaningless, at least for the greater part of Hans Christian Andersen's life. People did not think in those categories. And many of the things that Hans Christian Andersen did with men, like kissing, embracing, sending love letters,
were the social standard of the time.
Yes, that was what young men of the bourgeoisie did. Now, Hans Christian Andersen was a little over the top in this respect, but he was that in so many other respects. He was just a queer person, I think, in so many aspects of that word. He would do inappropriate things. He would be sort of like a monster baby. He would faint. He would pee in his pants. He would cry out. He would have hissy fits.
So he did all this as an adult?
Oh, yeah, all through his life. Yeah, I mean, and one might ask the question, was he ever an adult?
That's interesting, then, that he is so well known as the writer of children's tales, that were something about the imagination of childhood that he never really left behind.
And he did not like children, which is very, very funny, because they took away the attention from he being the monster child. I mean, he wanted all that kind of nurturing, and he got it. He was very good at it. He had, you know, a long row of aristocratic ladies who would mother him all through his life.
Now, I understand that you're famous in Denmark.
Or maybe infamous.
Infamous. And I would think doing anything to the figure of Hans Christian Andersen would be a bit tricky there. Can you tell us about your own sort of role and reception?
Absolutely. Well, and I do want to tell you that I did not start on this project before I had my tenure. Once you have tenure, you can say anything. Now, questioning the masculinity and the sexuality of Hans Christian, or heterosexuality of Hans Christian Andersen, you have to understand it's not just any undertaking. It is high treason. Because so much is invested in the icon of Hans Christian Andersen. He sort of embodies modern Denmark in a very particular way. And, you know, like national icons, and I don't think you can compare him with any one person in the U.S. because the U.S. is so diverse. But Hans Christian Andersen embodies Denmark in a way that maybe Shakespeare can in some ways say be said to embody Britain, Great Britain. So we are talking about a person whose body is the body of Denmark. Now, what has happened in Denmark in Hans Christian Andersen's lifetime? Well, Denmark has gotten a lot smaller. There's a Danish writer who talks about there was a great war in 1864 where Denmark lost a third of its country, like the southern part of the country, south of the border, one is tempted to say in many more respects than one. It was talked that Denmark at this point was castrated, you know, cut off by the hips because of this part that now belongs to Germany, right? So we have this, like, modern Denmark, this castrated country that is trying to survive, you know. It has become so small from being a sort of a fairly large power in Northern Europe. It has just gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. So we have this tiny little country trying to survive. And how do the Danes do it? Well, to this very day, we have reinvented ourselves as small but beautiful, like a fairy tale country. And the American tourists still buy into that image. And who is better at using that than Hans Christian Andersen? Because we have this incredibly famous creator of fairy tales that are known all over the world. So in some ways, Hans Christian Andersen he's been used to shape modern Danish identity. But only to a certain point. You want to be a fairy tale country, but you don't want to be castrated. Right. So much has been invented in creating and constructing Hans Christian Andersen as a masculine man and a heterosexual man. You were asking before, what makes me question that? Well, if you've seen any photos of Hans Christian Andersen, he was very vain, so there are tons of photos. He was a big, ugly, unattractive man, and you will not see a single photo where he does not have a limp wrist. So, I mean, that, you know, like, he was an effeminate, vain man who fell in love with some girls and quite a lot of men.
And so you have these biographical aspects of Andersen in terms of letters, for example, that he wrote to men as well as to women. I mean, he apparently wrote a lot of letters having to do with unrequited love, or at least that ended unrequited with women, but also occasionally, as you say, a little over the top in what he wrote to men that would go beyond the standard terms of affection of the early 19th century.
I would put it the other way around. He had, like, the majority of the love letters Hans Christian Andersen wrote was to men. And then he wrote a few to women. And these few have been, like, blown up in the Danish construction of Hans Christian Andersen as a heterosexual to have given way too much meaning. And there has been a general effort to try to explain away the much more elaborated love letters and the feelings he had to a lot of men.
Well, let's take a look at, for example, The Ugly Duckling that I opened with, a story that we all know where the ugly duckling turns out to be a beautiful swan. But the passage that I opened with where they're all pecking at him and even his siblings are persecuting him and his mother wishes he hadn't been born and so on. If you come to that story through the lens that you're putting on it, through queer theory, what is it that you do with The Ugly Duckling that makes it a new story?
Well, I think that there's, like, the genius of Hans Christian Andersen's text is that they can be read in so many different ways. And a lot of oppressed groups can see themselves in those texts. It could be maybe the story of a refugee coming to a foreign country. But, of course, the obvious reading is some kind of coming out story that you know, that would be sort of a gay allegorical way to read The Ugly Duckling.
Well, let's talk about The Little Mermaid. That's another tale that seems to have so many different layers of meaning. And
yes.
I'm not talking about the Disney version.
Well,
the
Disney
version
is good too.
The original version. Can you just kind of tell us the Little Mermaid story and what some of the things that intrigue you are about that story?
Yes, The Little Mermaid is a very fascinating tale. Hans Christian Andersen said it was the only tale that touched him while he wrote it. Maybe I should say a little bit about the biographical background, like what happened when Hans Christian Andersen was writing The Little Mermaid, because it was the big tragedy in Hans Christian Andersen's life. And here I want to counter the heteronormative Danish constructions that's a lot of official Denmark still keep retelling that he had three girls that he met at different points of life, and there were his three unhappy great loves. That is not true at all. The big unhappy love in Hans Christian Andersen's life was to sort of his adopted brother, Edvard Kulin. And what happened, like Hans Christian Andersen was sort of adopted into the Kulin family. The father was a very important man. He was head of the Royal Theatre. He was sort of like what in today's term would be the Minister of Culture. That would be his role translated into modern terms. And Jonas Kulin told his son, Edvard, to sort of take care of this strange country boy who could hardly read and write, but who had this incredible talent. They could see that already at a very, very young age. And Hans Christian Andersen, he did the same with Edvard that he did with the women. Every time he fell in love, he made sure that nothing would come of it.
Yeah,
so that's the same pattern with women and with men. Now he was never in love with other, like a little bit oversensitive, maybe effeminate, romantic men. No, he wanted traditional men, like reserved types, like Edvard Kulin. Because nothing would come of it, and Edvard would always draw the line when he became like when he was like smothering too much, or when his passion went overboard. And in his letters, Edvard would always draw the line. But Edvard is Hans Christian Andersen's lifelong love. Now, in 1836, something terrible, terrible happens in Hans Christian Andersen's life, and that is something that happened in young Andersen's life time and time again. He would fall in love with a young man, and you know that men of the bourgeoisie didn't marry until they were in their 30s. So there was a long, long period where they had no really sexual outlet. Instead, they formed these very important romantic friendships. I call them bosom brothers or bosom friends or brothers of the heart. And Hans Christian Andersen wanted to be a bosom brother with Edvard, and Edvard let him do it to a certain extent, but would always scold him for going over the top. Okay, 1836, Hans Christian Andersen's, the big tragedy is Edvard has married, or he has a fiancée. Now, a wedding is planned. It would be normal that Hans Christian Andersen would be the best man. He was the closest friend, and he was sort of the adopted brother. But the Kulin family knew that Hans Christian Andersen would not be able to deal with this. He would have a hissy fit, he would faint, he would scream, because he's already written some very strange letters to the fiancé of Edvard Kulin, right? He would write letters to Henriette Kulin. He would write to her, "Oh, Henriette, please say in your most tender and soft voice to Edvard, I love you. For me, because I'm not allowed to." And he would write her, "Kiss Edvard passionately on the mouth from me. He won't let me do it." Do you get it? So the woman is the medium of this forbidden, for these forbidden emotions between men. Now, what happens is that this has happened time and time again in Hans Christian Andersen's life, that these women take these bosom friends away from him. In Hans Christian Andersen's early work, and I'm talking about the novels that he wrote before he really wrote the fairy tales, he would write these novels, and they're all about young, sensitive men who have a very passionate relationship, you know, bosom brothers. Now, just like Hans Christian Andersen experienced them himself. Now, what happens in the fiction, I mean, there he can decide everything, is that the men, they, of course, these bosom brothers fall in love with the same girl, or they fall in love with each other's sisters. Do you get it? Mm-hmm. So it stays within the family, right? And in the novels, they never marry because something else happens, and it's not so sad, and that is the women die.
That's convenient.
A very common phenomenon in 1830s fiction.
Yes, but there is a pattern in Hans Christian Andersen's early work where they always die. And you can predict in the stories if this woman, if you have this pattern of these two bosom brothers, then this woman enters, it's a danger zone. Mm. It's very dangerous for this woman to come in between these men because they don't survive it. So I spent my 2005 book, I call it Bosom Brothers, counting the corpses, the female corpses piling up in Hans Christian Andersen's early work. So you can say that what happened in Hans Christian Andersen's life, or these women that steal away his bosom friends, his bosom brothers, he kills them off one after the other in Hans Christian Andersen's work. Now, what happened in 1836 is now it's Edvard Kulin's turn, and the Kulin family didn't invite him to the wedding, so he is far, far away. He's out in the provinces on the island of Fyn. He's on a manor house. He would stay for months at manor houses and be pampered and then write and do readings and play with the children, or, you know, trying to be the child himself. And so he is out there. He knows something terrible, terrible is happening in Copenhagen. That's a disaster. He can do nothing about it. So he writes this beautiful, sad story about this creature, this little mermaid who belongs in the ocean and who meets this prince and who transforms into a girl and then doesn't get the prince after all. Now, the image of the mermaid is a very, very strange choice for some kind of like victim heroine. And even the way, you know, like the little mermaid, because the mermaid, of course, is a creature. It's a witch of the sea. And it's like saturated, of course, with sexuality. I mean, we know the sirens in mythology and literature. So what he takes is an hypersexualized creature and making it into sort of a sort of almost desexualized martyr, like, and she ends up being an angel because she doesn't get this prince. But what happens is that she gives up her tail, and she then walks on land. But
it's very painful.
It's very painful.
Doesn't she lose her voice?
She has to give up her voice, and she has to give up her tail. Now, what is a mermaid, a siren, without a voice? I mean, we have this hyper-sexualized figure whose very essence is to enchant men without a voice. I mean, the word castration isn't strong enough. I know this is not a political correct metaphor, but to me, it's almost like a little mermaid without her voice. It's like a prostitute in a wheelchair. She just can't hit the streets, right? So this is this is a very strange way, or queer or weird way. And to me, I would read it in a biographical allegory as Hans Christian Andersen fantasizing of a transsexual, a sex change. What happened? I'm not talking, of course, about a surgical sex change, but it's Hans Christian Andersen fantasizing of what happened if I cut off my tail or whatever is between my legs, right? And it's like, then when he realizes, first of all, this is gonna hurt. It's like walking on knives. Secondly, no, the prince is not gonna want me anyway. Edvard Kulin, he wants a tailless princess, a princess that never had a tail. So there's nothing else for me to be some kind of angel. And that is because I'm not gonna die, but I'm gonna be a spirit, because like the Little Mermaid, she becomes a daughter of the air. So that is the kind of reading that I think is interesting. And I don't know if you know Copenhagen, but the most important symbol of Copenhagen is the famous statue in the harbor of Copenhagen in Lange Linje, where of the Little Mermaid. And I think it's a wonderful idea to think of, oh, maybe she's a pre-operated transsexual.
We're going to explore the work of another famous Danish writer when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dag Hede, and we are talking about the Danish literary canon and approaching it in new ways. We've been talking about Hans Christian Andersen, obviously the best-known Danish writer in the world. Would you say the second best-known Danish writer would be Dinesen?
Absolutely.
And that's her pen name, right? Tell us the real story of who she is
yes.
and what she wrote.
Karen Blixen is her real name. And one of the very strange thing about Karen Blixen's writing, or Isak Dinesen, is that she wrote in two languages. And that we are so happy for that because we have scholarship. We have a lot of wonderful, wonderful English scholarship, American scholarship on Dinesen. And she wrote all her texts first in English and then in Danish. As she got older, there were more like translations, but her very first book, Seven Gothic Tales, she actually didn't just translate into Danish, she rewrote it. And that text, I have to say, I have to disappoint the American readers that the Danish version is actually superior to the English. But we are so happy that she also wrote in English because we got some wonderful American Dinesen scholars like Susan Brantley here in Madison, who's written a fabulous book on Dinesen or Blixen.
And in this case, we have an author who very much gets us into modern, if not contemporary, times.
She does, but she writes in a style that would be clearly the style of the 19th century, even though she wrote her debut in 1935. But she wrote Gothic, Seven Gothic Tales. So she writes in a style of an earlier time, and actually a style that mimics an even earlier time. So it's quite mm-hmm. complex.
That's true. The Gothic does kind of recur through literary history.
And most Americans probably, if they know her, might know her through Out of Africa, the book she wrote and the movie made about her. To what extent is that autobiographical? And what do we know about her actual life?
Well, Karen Blixen was genius at promoting herself and also of making myths out of her life. So it's a very difficult question because, you know, we don't really know who she actually was, because she would have one mask after the other and she would have one myth telling after the other. One way of reading or answering your question is like comparing the letters she wrote from Africa to her family. They have been published in two wonderful volumes as well, also translated into English. And they often tell quite different stories, even at the factual level. So it's sort of... I would say that Out of Africa is based on her experiences, but I think, you know, she's an artist, so she created a work of art. And if you compare it with the letters, they are often very, very different stories. I mean, it's too good to be true, I think, some of the things she writes in Out of Africa.
And so how would you reinterpret the writings of Isak Dinesen?
Well, what I did, I worked a lot on the first book, The Seven Gothic Tales, which to me, I think, is an even better book than Out of Africa. I know that people maybe prefer Out of Africa, but do give The Seven Gothic Tales a chance, because they are just a wonderful Pandora's box of perversion. It's a can of worms. It's like opening up, you know, this is just like an incredible, interesting, queer and perverse universe where like gender is thrown up in the air, sexuality is thrown out there. You have no idea what gender or sex these characters are or have or try to do. They don't know themselves. The people they are attracted to, they don't know either which sex they are or gender, you know. And they change clothes all the time. And then, you know, they put on a wig and then change sex. So you can see that every notion of heterosexuality, homosexuality, bisexuality, they don't make sense if you don't know the first thing about the gender of these people, and if you don't know, and they don't know who they desire or what gender they desire, because they don't know they desire a body, but they don't know how that body is gendered. And that kind of gender trouble I absolutely loved. And that was also very forbidden, at least in Danish scholarship. And again, the American Blixen, Dinesen scholarship opened up new paths. Like, we very much need a much more thorough feminist reading of Hans Christian Andersen. So if anyone out there, that is really lacking in Andersen scholarship. But we have some fantastic feminist American scholarship. Susan Hardy Eigen has written a wonderful book, maybe the best book on Dinesen at all. And so we have really this highly theoreticized scholarship that even the Danish Blixen scholars are slowly getting to know also.
And what about attitudes in Denmark, both during her time or even today, toward the kind of work you do or towards kind of an open attitude towards sexuality?
Well, I have to say that a myth that I have very much been playing into is that the Danes themselves believe that they are an incredibly enlightened and tolerant and sexually liberated country. And that myth has some reality to it. You know, like Denmark was the first country to liberalize pornography. We were the first country to introduce some kind of same-sex marriage. So there is a myth you can play with and play into, and that is what I have been doing. I think there is something with the literary canon and like literary history as a discipline in all aspects of that word, that maybe there probably tends to be a certain conservatism into that, especially, well, at least in Danish literary scholarship. I believe the English-speaking world is much more open to new ideas.
And with Karen Blixen, is there evidence from her life that she had an interest in sort of fluid gender categories in exploring taboo subjects?
Oh, absolutely. Now, Karen Blixen is a very strange character on the Danish literary scene because she lived in Africa for so, so many years. And when she came back, she was in her, you know, she was not a young woman anymore, and she was in a way out of touch of Danish life. Denmark at that time was a social democratic country, an egalitarian country, and this bizarre person comes back who's sort of, you know, she's halfway an aristocrat. Not really, because she was divorced from her Swedish cousin, who was the one who was the baron, but she still insisted to be a baroness, but she actually wasn't anymore, because not when you were divorced. But she, and you know, in Denmark in the 30s, you know, coming there and thinking you are something and insisting on being called the baroness, it's like that just didn't make sense to the Danish audiences. So she was a very bizarre figure. I think she hated Denmark for the rest of her life. And that's a lot of hatred of provincialism and Danishness in these texts.
Well, we see that in Scandinavian literature in general. I mean, if you were to read, you know, Ibsen in Norway, he would certainly take issue with provincialism and these ironclad notions of sexual roles.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there one particular tale from the seven Gothic tales that you can tell us about that illustrates her, I guess, her playing around with different figures?
Well, I myself, one of my favorite tales is The Monkey, which is about a... And the interesting thing about Karen Blixen, and I have to tell you, when I did my work, I myself did not live in Denmark. And I think it's very important because in a small country, there are ways in which the country imprisons the way you think. So there are really thoughts that you do not dare to think. Now, I was a young, angry man who could not get a job in academia in Denmark. I went to Munich in Germany and was teaching Danish there. But it gave me a kind of liberty, a space to think outside of the box. And I had met queer theory. I had read Judith Butler at the time, Gender Trouble, and it worked fantastically on Karen Blixen. And one of the things that I realized, oh my God, in Karen Blixen's work, it is the norm that men prefer men. And I was like so shocked to realize that all of these men are sort of gay. Well, they prefer men, but they take girls also because you have to, and it doesn't work out. I mean, it's like it's when boy meets girl in Count Vixen, and the result is disaster every time. It's murder, it's killing, it's like so there is some connection between heterosexual copulation and death, and it's there all of the time. So,
well, but, that was sort of true for her, wasn't it? That she came down with syphilis thanks to apparently her husband.
I love that you mentioned that. And when did that happen? On her wedding night. Mm-hmm. So to her, heterosexuality and poison are completely combined. Now, this is a wonderful Danish pun, but it doesn't work in English. But I have to tell anyway that the word for married in Danish is the same as the word for poison.
Really?
So marriage is a mutual poisoning. And once I found out that, I had so much fun. Now, Danish Blixen scholarship didn't get any of that. You know, they think in women and men and heterosexuality. And it's all blind. It's like, oh, my God, it's pathetic to read. They don't get any. I'm not talking about that, of course, you can interpret text in different ways. But you have to understand the basic plots. And there's no pardon. You have to get that. And none of the Danish Blixen scholars understood any of that, right? So when I, and since I was so mad at Danish academia, I wanted to create a hate gift to Danish intellectual life. So it's like, this is the angry young man. So I said, oh, queering Count Blixen. Let's go back to the monkey. Typical Count Blixen story. The protagonist, young, beautiful lieutenant, of course, like dark hair, small, blue eyes, gorgeously looking. And of course, he's in some kind of scandal, right? And what could that be? No doubt about it. You know, he's got too many friends and too intimate friends. And that's it. So, okay. So, and it's, of course, it says a scandal a la Grec, like of a Greek nature. And we all know what that is, Greek
right.
love. Okay.
Sure.
So he is in a lot of trouble. So he goes to his aunt, Katinka, who is the prioress of some kind of like non-religious cloister, right? Sort of a retreat for aristocratic ladies. Now, Katinka is a woman, even though she's withdrawn from the world, she has many talents and she has a monkey. And she's very close to that monkey. And all of the ladies all have their pets. Now, sometimes the monkey disappears and Katinka is completely out of it. But then the monkey comes back and then she's fine again. Okay. So Katinka, so he says, okay, aunt, I'm in big trouble. You got to help me out. So then the aunt suddenly gets a letter and she reads it. And then she licks her mouth. I mean, she likes girls, of course, also. She said, what about you and my little friend, Athene Hotballehus, now, which is, she is the daughter of the neighbor count. And now Boris thinks this is really strange because, I mean, he's a small, little, beautiful guy. And Athena is a huge woman of 18 years old. And he said she's got a pair of shoulders that can carry a barrel of wheat on them. Right? And what she can do is she can, with one arm, she can lift herself up and her horse. Right? So, I mean, okay. So, but he's like, okay. I mean, he likes grotesque things and he's open to the pleasures of the world. And he's like, open to new things. So it's like, okay, let's go. So Athene, so the aunt writes a letter of proposal for Boris and he is on his way. It's a very, very strange scene. One of these old ladies comes out and gives him three flowers and it says they were to accompany him as bridesmaids. There's something wrong there already. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the guy proposing. He's not supposed to have bridesmaids, right? This is all wrong. Okay, so he goes to this house. Well, then it turns out that the count is very happy to see him because he has inherited, he has won this case and has inherited a huge fortune. But nobody knows that, except remember that the Katinka got a letter. So the aunt knew that. So anyway, so he spends a nice time there. Boris, the count, the first thing he says to Boris is, oh, Boris, my child. which is sort of a bit uncanny because we know that he was one of the admirers of Bowie's mother. So maybe he really is his father, right? Which is sort of, okay. So, and what would that make Athena to Bowie? Well, you know, the marriage isn't going to be consummated probably anyway, right? So it's like, what, maybe it's brother, sister, or half-brother, half-sister, right? Okay. So, and then Athena comes in, this huge woman, you know, like big, strong woman, and she wants to fight. She wants to go into the army. She wants to kill off people. She wants to go to Burma because there they fight with tigers, you know, use tigers in the army. She wants that. Okay. He delivers the letter, he goes back, and then, you know, like he and the aunt have a wonderful time together, sort of licking their mouths, you know, of all the money and the girl and all that. But then they got this letter that Athena, who has never, it says about her, she's never seen herself in a mirror. You know, she has no feeling of you know, like of her body, of her gender. She's lived to, isolated with her father. Now, she said, oh, I will never marry at all. Okay, what do they do now? And, you know, we have this scandal that Bowie has to marry, you know, to
prove he's heterosexual.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So Katinka, she knows what she's doing, and then there's the monkey and sort of so she says, oh, well, she has to come and tell us ourselves, you know. And then Bowie said, well, what if she doesn't want me? Then Katinka licks her mouth and she says, oh, little Bowie, if she will not have you, then I will. It's like, it's very scary. And Bowie is like, well, I don't think so. Anyway, so she prepares this seduction dinner, right? And they have this, like, this wonderful meal, and of course the aunt makes sure that Athena gets incredibly drunk. But then, because Athena is such a huge person, it doesn't really affect her. And but then she says, well, she tells Athena, well, you can't go back. You have to sleep in this guest room. So and so Athena does that. And then after that, when the aunt and Bowie are alone, then the aunt says, well, you know, you've got to do something. And then Bowie says, well, I have to tell you, but there are limits to what a man can do. But she knows that. She gives him a little drink, and it's, of course, rhinoceros.
An aphrodisiac.
An aphrodisiac. And then that Bowie walks right in to this room, and this room is incredibly sort of vaginal room, you know, with like two lamps and everything is red and everything is veiled and, you know, everything. I mean, it is the female body, right? There's like this carpet, this thick carpet that one would not really want to step out into. You get it? Okay. But in the middle of that room, there is Athena, and she is undressing, and she is, you know, in her chemise, all in white, and it says she looks like a sailor boy who was about to clean the deck.
That's an odd choice to say.
Well, maybe that's an interesting something that would make Bowie interested in her, right? You know?
Sailors, yes. Right.
A little sailor boy. Well, not a little, a big sailor boy. So he jumps at her, and it says, I mean, the phallic symbolism with Athena, it says her. She is like a smith with his hammer. She bangs right into his face, and she takes out two of his teeth. And there's blood all over the mouth. And Bowie really likes this. I mean, he sort of gets off. It's like something happens to him. He feels like it's a bird flying up from the top of the tree. And he's like, oh, this is really interesting, right? But she also does something else. She has her big, big hands around his throat. And she's on the way to suffocating him, right? So he's like, well, he has one weapon. He gives her, you know, he has had this one drink also, so there's something going for him. He gives her a kiss. And then, of course, she faints. She's never been kissed. So she faints with disgust. And then she just lies there. And then Bowie's like, the text says, well, the drink was probably good for only one occasion. So he just leaves. Okay, the next day, Bowie comes with his mouth is like twice as big, of course, and Athena comes there, and the aunt, now she says, Oh, Athena, I'm not trying to excuse what happened. There is no excuse for what Boris did, but at least he has the decency to marry you now that you are probably pregnant. And then Athena's like, what? I'm pregnant? And then they said, well, I know you don't know about the ways of the world, but yes, you will give birth to a bastard, and that will break your father's heart. And so Athena says, okay, I will marry him, but I swear, dear aunt, that on the morning of the marriage, I will kill him. And then it's like, okay, well, the aunt is really, really smart and shrewd. She doesn't really know what to do. So as they just did, the three of them just stare at each other. So what happens? There's a little tapping on the window, and the monkey who's disappeared all along, he gets a stone, and he breaks the window. Now the old aunt, she is terrified. She leaps forward, lifts up all her skirts, you know, exposes everything, and tries to escape. The monkey jumps at her. And then they have this fight. And during this fight, it says, then happens this metamorphosis. And the ant suddenly becomes a monkey who hides in the corner of the room. And it says, and then a little red in her cheeks raises, gets up the true prioress of the convent, right?
It's a strange story.
It would be very interesting to know what Isaac Dinesen had been drinking. I think not rhinoceros juice in this case.
Well, the thing is, of course, if you want a quick interpretation, is that she imagined herself the rape and the pregnancy, right? But she acted them out on other people.
Sure.
Now it's sort of kind of hybris nemesis, like the revenge of the truth. Now things turn out differently, and she makes other people embody her thoughts, but she has to do it herself. Well, so the pregnancy that she says Athena has, well, Boris has it with his mouth. I mean, because what happens that night is that Athena takes the virginity of Boris, right? Mm-hmm. With her big fist in his mouth. The blood all over, and Boris is maybe pregnant. You see, like a symbolic pregnancy in his face with a swollen mouth, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, so Boris has to be the one pregnant, but the whole rape scene is being acted out on the body of Katinka when the monkey jumps at her and she is sort of exposed. And this whole rape thing is, of course, like, this fight is a rape, right? And the metamorphosis, like this monkey coming out of the prioress, of the ant, that is, of course, a symbolic giving birth. Do you see it? So, in a way, things turn back on this woman.
Well, we're going to speculate some more on what's behind Danish literature. We'll look at some other authors for a few minutes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Dag Hede, and we're looking at Danish writers, but with a different approach. And the ones that have been familiar, perhaps, so far, Hans Christian Andersen and Isaac Dinesen. But I gather, Dag, that you have some more in mind, too.
Well, I have worked with what I could call maybe the Scandinavian equivalent to Oscar Wilde, a Danish writer called Herman Bang. Bang was like had the position in the Scandinavian countries like Oscar Wilde. He was sort of the first modern out gay writer and also like gay persona. He wrote a number of novels, and he was very, very popular and very respected at the time, but he was also very controversial because he embodied the figure of the homosexual. Actually, people would use, they didn't really know the word gay or homosexual, so they would say, oh, that person is a bang.
It became synonymous.
An eponym, huh?
Yes.
And was Herman Bang aware of Oscar Wilde?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Did he sort of try to copy some of his dandyism and sort of...
He was a little earlier than Oscar Wilde, I would almost mm-hmm. they had very similar ways of being. But no, there was no question of copy because he was before Oscar Wilde.
Would you say that Denmark was more accepting of Herman Bang than England was of Oscar Wilde?
I think if you look at the history of the legal position of homosexuality, we never had the kind of laws that Britain had. Britain had one of the harshest laws on sexuality in all of Europe.
So the Herman Bang would not have had to spend time in jail the way Oscar Wilde did.
No, he never did that. He never did that. But he did suffer a lot of persecution. He did suffer a lot of blackmail.
And what sort of things did he write?
Herman Bang is very, very famous for telling quiet stories about quiet people, like small little people in the province, women who maybe suffered without words, are very, very famous. He's also, even though he himself was very eloquent and all over the place, he had an incredible ear for how people think and how people say. And the mastery of Herman Bang is that in one line, there could be a whole life's suffering in just one word or the way that a person would say one word. So you talk about reading between the lines, and that's what you have to do with Herman Bang.
What are some of the titles of books that he... Well, or if you could recommend just one book.
You should start with the tiny novel, or maybe it's just a short story. It's called By the Roadside or Katinka. I think there are different translations in English. It's a very quiet, non-dramatic little story about the quiet suffering of a woman. She is married. She is sort of not rebellious at all. She has this brutal husband who sort of rapes her. The husband is like has children with other women. And then this quiet, sensitive man comes to that little town and the two of them fall in love. But you can't imagine them like doing anything about it. So this man leaves and poor Katinka is left with her suffering and she dies. And that's all. So it's not like reading for the plot. Not much happens, but it's a masterful description of this quiet suffering where everything is said between the lines. It's just like in the tiny little pauses. It's in the blush of a face. So much information is given there if you take the time and the patience. And it's absolutely wonderful. I hope the English translation is good because everything is about language in this text.
And how does this tie in with your observations that we've seen so far of Hans Christian Andersen and Isak Dinesen? How would Herman Bang tie in?
Well, he also write much longer novels, and he would write sort of allegories of homosexual. He would write about degenerate young men who met with older women, which I think are allegories of older gay men, and it'll end in their total destruction. He wrote those kind of things. And of course, like, you know, at the sign of the time, the homosexual would always die because, you know, it has to be a happy ending. And a good homosexual, of course, is a dead homosexual. He would write all that into his text. But he would also smuggle in a very discreet critique of heterosexuality and reproduction.
So he would be appearing to go along with the typical plot, but subverting it at the same time.
Yes, for ones who have the open ear could see that marriage is always destructive.
And marriage and poison mean the same word in Danish.
Exactly.
An interesting point.
Yes.
Our guest has been Dag Hede, and he has been filling us in on alternative approaches to Danish literature. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.